Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 376 for May 5 of 2017. What the heck is going on in that Corvette plant? Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Autoline After Hours. My co-host, Gary Vasilash, is not here. He's abandoned me to go to Hawaii so he can drive the new Honda Odyssey minivan, the dog. But he'll be back here next week. In any case, joining us today are Seth Miersma from MotorOne.com, Chester Dawson from The Wall Street Journal, and Lindsay Brook from SAE. And great to have all three of you guys here.
Thank you.
And we got a lot to talk about, so let's get going. I think, Seth, why don't I throw it open to you, but everybody join in. We heard this week that GM is shutting down plant tours of the Corvette factory, and that has triggered a firestorm of speculation. So take it from there.
It's like one of my favorite Tom Waits songs, What Are They Building In There, right? What is he building in there? So, of course, everybody wants this to be the mid-engine Corvette, right?
Well, explain it a bit.
So there's an 18... They're going to close off the end of the existing tours, I think, around July, mid-July.
Something like
and
that.
And then after
for
that,
18 months.
After that, there's 18 months of no tours. So, speculation is sort of rampant. The official GM line is that the paint shop is being moved from, I guess, one side of the factory to the other, and that they're going to try and create a better tour experience. So, of course, that has everybody on the internet buzzing about what it really is. Is this a new getting the engine production ready for the new V8? Is this the mid-engine Corvette? Is really, again, what everybody kind of wants it to be? Or is it none of the above or something else? I don't really know. I have a feeling that it's more than a paint shop. Let's put it that way. But
yeah, I would pick B. I would pick that there are tooling the plan for the new Corvette.
Mm-hmm. New Corvette?
Well, the C8 Corvette, a mid-engine, complete.
Oh,
new
you mean mid-engine?
So yeah, mid-engine, yeah, new architecture. The hard points in the chassis where the engine would fit in would not require that much time. I mean, the engine's done somewhere else, and that's just going to fit in there. So I would go with B on that.
I'd say the same thing. We're probably close in another year or so for a major refresh of the Vette. Hasn't it been out 4 years now?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you'd think it's about time for a refresh, but you don't tear up a plant for 18 months to do a refresh. You change the front and rear fascia and call it a day.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, too, there's an element of, this press release came out. I think it was actually the Corvette Museum in Bowling Green that at least where they stage it and put out the press release, too. So it's coming out that this is all coming to light in a really interesting way, too, that makes you wonder, is this kind of a provocative way of teasing out what's really happening? This has been the biggest story. I mean, I've been writing car news online for 10 years now, and the mid-engine Corvette story was the biggest story then, too. It is now. So you can't just come out and say it. I think there's got to be a little romance happening for sure.
Well, look, if you're going to cut off plant tours, you got to let people know we're not going to have plant tours. So I wouldn't read too much into that.
But I'm going to take the long odds and say it's going to be the new levitating all-electric Corvette to debut in 2020.
The size of an Escalade, too. Mm-hmm. The Corvette Escalade, right. So speaking of sports cars, Seth, you just got a chance to drive the McLaren 720S.
I did, yeah.
What do you think?
I was out in Italy, so I got a really, really good look at the car, both on some great roads and on a racetrack, too. And it's a phenomenal piece of work. I think McLaren, I've been really excited about the McLarens that I've been in because they're, although the technology is kind of incredible, the powertrain is amazing for this car. We're talking about 710 horsepower from 4-liter V8, which is just blowing. blows my mind. It feels, to a certain extent, it feels light and plugged in like older cars do or did to me more than, you know, even something like an R8, which is a phenomenally fast car, tends to be a little bit detached. And so I think McLaren is really like playing to that kind of super enthusiast taste, and it's a lot of fun.
You're a tall guy. You fit in it?
Yeah, absolutely. So they've done a really good job with the what do they call them? Dihedral doors, they lift up.
Scalloped.
So they cut out the top. Yeah, so that there's, and the carbon fiber tub, which is a new generation of tub for McLaren, I think it's called Mono Cage 2, is lower. So in those, you know, some of these old supercars, the carbon fiber tubs would be really high. You've got to step over and then kind of drop
the sills
in.
Are always high.
Exactly, yeah. So the sills are a lot lower on this. Plus, there's the big cutout for the door. So, you know, I'm 6'5". I can still drop into the car pretty easily and have enough room. I'm eating my knees a little bit, but, you know, it's a McLaren.
Now, were they talking hybridization? They've been kind of
absolutely
walking down that line a little bit.
Yeah, I think that we're, I think, so this car falls into their sort of mid-tier, which is they call the Super Series. And I think that there are going to be a few more products that are using this powertrain, the 4-liter, twin turbocharged 4-liter. But I think everything from above that, the Ultimate Series, which was the P1 that's done now, is going to have some level of electrification with it. And then down the road, that's going to find its way, I think, into all of the range for McLaren. That's they have an F1 lineage, and that's where F1 is.
Don't you think all supercars are going to go that way?
I think they have to, yeah.
You know, because you get so much better acceleration with electric.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the torque pop that you get and the way that they're reducing the size of motors, they're reducing the size of batteries, they're increasing the overall output, and generally, you know, making a performance hybrid something that's really desirable and not just necessary anymore, which I think is fantastic. So, yeah, it's an exciting time in the world of $300,000.
Is that supercars. What's the cost?
Yeah, the MSRP theoretically in the U.S. is $284 and some change, but I don't think you'll sell that car under $300,000. I mean, you get 3 carbon fiber packages and it adds $20,000 to the bottom line. So
should Ferrari be worried about McLaren at all?
I mean, do you think Ferrari ever worries about anybody else?
Good answer.
No, I mean, a Ferrari is its own thing. If people want a Ferrari, they have to get on a waiting list. And I think McLaren wants to be there. I think with this car, it's already the first year of it is sold out, or the production is nearly sold out. So they're getting to that point of having a high level of desire for the brand. But you got to remember, too, McLaren Automotive is, what, 7 years old now or something? So the fact that they're where they're at, I think, at starting 2010 or 2011, to me is pretty remarkable. Uh-huh. So,
and what's a year's production for them?
They, what is it? I think it's under 4,000 last year. And
that many?
Yeah.
Wow.
They want
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
They want a hard cap at 5,000 too. I mean, I've been to a couple of their launches and presentations, and they've drummed home this message that there will be more capacity than they'll want to make cars at a certain point. So I think 5,000 is really where they're at right now in terms of the ceiling to maintain that desirability. You know, if you want to compete with Porsche, Ferrari, Lamborghini, those guys.
Yeah, but, you know, Ferrari, which has sort of artificially capped itself as, I want to say, 7,000 mm-hmm. cars a year, is bumping that up to 9,000,
yeah,
which is a big percentage gain.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you look at what's opening up in the world, especially like China, and, you know, India is going to be next on the list and other places, I think the global market can easily absorb that increase.
Yeah, the global universe of billionaires continues to rise, right. You know.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that if they can sell more cars, they would want to make more cars. I don't know if they're kind of drawing that line in the sand right now, so they really are able to generate that long-term demand for the brand, or you know, how serious they are about it maybe 10 years down the road. But that's a number that I've heard repeated from them a few times. Mm-hmm. So,
interesting. Hmm. Well, some of the other news that broke this week is we got sales for April in the American market. Chester, anything that stood out in the sales numbers to you?
Well, for the Chicken Littles, it was, you know, Deliverance, you know, here again, another month of lower sales. I personally, I'm not sure. You could see the glass half empty or half full. I mean, clearly the market is plateauing at best and probably going to come down a peg or two, as has been widely forecast. So this is, you know, not unusual in that respect. And, you know, for the glass half full folks, I mean, if we're down 1%, you know, that's still not $13 million. It's $17 million, or maybe, you know, in the worst case scenario, $60 million, some and change. You know, I guess the question going forward for the industry is this just a, you know, sustainable, or are we, you know, at a peak and we're going to see, you know, the industry start to fall apart? I don't think there's a lot of evidence of the latter, to be honest, quite yet. People point to the fact that used car values are down and that cars are more expensive. The affordability question is coming into play. That's true, although, you know, for the broader economy, you know, incomes are up, you know, housing values are up. So by some of the traditional, you know, macro indicators, it's there are not a ton of signs showing clouds on the horizon. On the other hand, you know, I don't think we're going to be at 18 million anytime soon.
Yeah. No, to me, I agree with, you know, most everybody was reporting that sales were down about 5%, but there was one less selling day April this year than a year ago. Easter fell in April this year. It was in March last year.
There's 2 days out of the cycle.
Well, one selling day, but a weekend where a whole lot of people don't go car shopping. Mm-hmm. You know, they're taking time off, they're doing family stuff, whatever. So I don't think the market is that weak. If you look at the first 4 months total, I think it's off 2.5% or something like that, which is down, but it's not the end of the world. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see sales climb back up again later in the year because of what you're talking about. Unemployment continues to fall. More people are coming back into the workforce. Wages are going up. Gasoline prices are cheap. Credit's still relatively well available. I mean, this is all a good mix for car sales.
Oh, what a feeling.
You know? On the other hand, it feels like a really good time to get a great deal on a sedan, doesn't it? Because everybody is by the segments that are up are all SUV, crossover, especially the smaller ones right now. So an incentive spend, I guess, is up a little bit, too, overall. So it feels like if you're in the market for, you know, an Accord sedan, maybe I don't know specifically about Honda, but now might be the time.
Yeah, no, not so much Honda. You know, they're so retail focused.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
You want to go after the guys who are dumping cars into the rental fleets because there's where you're going to get a killer deal.
And it's interesting, too, because if you take, say, Fiat Chrysler, where they're kind of getting out of sedans, and that's, you know, at one level a big risk. I mean, if gas goes back to $5 a gallon, this may be the worst business decision ever taken. But as long as Jeeps and Ram trucks are rolling out, you know, even Ram even passing the Silverado from GM, you know, they're going to make hay while the sun is shining.
Yeah. You know, I was just reading somebody that was commenting on, you know, with this slowdown in the market, maybe they're going to have to cut back in production. Maybe somebody's going to have to close a plant. They were speculating a lot of stuff. But that was their point. It's going to be all passenger car plants that close or throttle back.
Yeah.
None of the truck or SUV plants are going to throttle back. And FCA is down to what? On the Chrysler side, the Chrysler Old Corp side of thing, they're down to one passenger car plant, the Bramley plant in Canada. And those sales are actually doing not half bad.
But it's funny, you know, those cars, and I'm driving a 392 Challenger right now, it just seems like it's been around forever.
You know why? Because it has.
I know that. I mean, walking through the FCA display at the auto show was like walking through a car museum, you know? But they continue to iterate with paint jobs and with engine packages, more horsepower, wheels and stuff. They continue to just make hay with this thing.
Look at all the hay they made with the Demon. I mean, they milked that intro for all it's worth.
Yeah.
And I don't have the numbers in front of me. I believe Challenger sales were up last month.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how Demon pays for itself. You know, they're going to sell a few handfuls of these things. Mm. But it's generated so much buzz about Dodge, you know, people are going, oh, Dodge, I got to go to the Dodge store.
Speaking of Demon, what do you guys think of the controversy of, is it a dangerous car? Automotive News had an editorial on that, and I think it was based around semi-slick tires that are being sold with this car, mm-hmm. which to me is just a simple upsell from the dealer level. you know.
What's faster, a McLaren 720S or a Demon?
The commenters on Motor One tell me that the Demon is faster.
Okay.
And they want to make sure that I know that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't know about danger. Listen, if you put 800-plus horsepower into any car, isn't it slightly more dangerous than a Camry, right? I mean, it's dangerous, but I don't know that it's really like crossing a threshold when you've got, a wealth of engineers putting this package together and telling you that it's good and what it's good for, right? That package is for the drag.
Here we got the clip of the thing lighting up at the intro.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, look, a Tesla Model S in ludicrous mode is probably just as quick.
Maybe quicker to 0 to 60.
Yeah. So is Automotive News calling for a ban on that? Of course not.
Right.
Well, the other thing is this all plays to their marketing. You know, they want to be the bad boys with this, you know, so... You know, they weren't making any bones about the fact that it couldn't get approval for, you know, whatever from this organization and making it street legal. I just feel like, you know, they're kind of watching this and probably laughing because they're getting a lot of extra publicity out of it.
Right.
And it's going to the very, you know, not everybody's going to want a Demon, right? That's a pretty niche audience. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that it draws attention to the brand, you know, so much the better. And as you were saying earlier, I mean, a lot of their vehicles, I was just looking at numbers for the Caravan. And in April, that was the first month this year that sales of the brand new Pacifica beat the Caravan. The Caravan debuted in 2007. It's a 10-year-old vehicle.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing how much they're getting out of their older vehicles. But, you know, I guess it shows that they're not able to invest as much. They don't have the cash other companies do. So they're trying to make, the best with what they've got.
Plus, I think Automotive News was just looking for controversy.
Sure.
You know, generate as much as they could. What I found even more interesting is Keith Crane, you know, who owns the whole Crane Communications thing, wrote an editorial in Auto Week, sister publication, saying Automotive News is wrong.
Yeah, right.
I thought Keith wrote the first article in the first editorial.
right.
But, you know, to me, it's, look, if you're going to pick on the Demon because it's designed to be a race car, I don't know how you can't say ban everything that's just as fast.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. Yeah, the P100D Tesla is like a 2.2 second to 60 car. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty quick.
Pretty quick.
So, yeah, I think Automotive News got what it wants. Or whoever on Automotive News' staff wrote that editorial got what they wanted.
Yeah.
They got a lot of people talking about them.
Sure.
The Demon traffic is the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
So it made the New York show, and it's sort of hasn't really flatlined after that. So,
hey, look, we got a lot more to talk to, but we also got to take a quick break right now because we got to make sure that we give a good recognition to the people who make these shows kind of possible. The ones who sponsor it are going to give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay. We're back. We're talking about all kinds of things going on in the automotive industry right now. And let me call up what we have here. Lindsay, you just flew in this morning from the coast because you were out in California. Intel was doing some big yoo-ha-ha about how automotive they're becoming.
And an autonomous driving workshop, which I feel as a reporter usually to be pretty valuable because, you know, it's a chance to go around and talk to subject experts in all sorts of areas. The guy who's in charge of over-the-air, connectivity, 5G, DSRC, talking about the enormous amount of data that's going to be flowing into vehicles, already flowing into vehicles, but once we go to more autonomy in the vehicle, 45 terabytes per hour. Now, I have no baseline for what a terabyte is, but it's a lot of data.
Yeah.
And there's going to be more and more. Now, everything that comes into the vehicle, there's a lot of ephemeral data that really isn't data that can be used or retransmitted somewhere. It's just data to dynamically keep things going. But I think the point that Intel was trying to make is processing speed for these chips has to go up. Capability of the chips has got to go up. The car is going to be talking to other cars, talking to the cloud. It's a really interesting time to be looking at this autonomous connected period.
And you're the one who made the point. It's like here's this classic Silicon Valley company that wants to become an automotive supplier.
Right. Well, they were there with Delphi, and Delphi is a partner of theirs. And they were there, BMW was there as well. So it's this kind of like triumvirate partnership. And Delphi is trying to become a tech company. There's no question. For valuations, and you know, they just recently spun off their powertrain business a couple days ago. They're going to be doing that. That'll be completed by, I think, March 18. So they'd like to be considered to be a tech company. Intel, on the other hand, was almost seems like they want to be an automotive tier one or an automotive supplier. So really interesting stuff going on. And obviously their big competitors are the NVIDIAs of the year and the of the world and the Qualcomms of the world and the Infineons of the world. So there's this chip war that's going on right now, again, to process data that's going into the vehicle and out of the vehicle.
What's your take on all this move in the valley? Are they going to be significant players, or are they just going to become another in the line of automotive suppliers?
Well, I think for a while there'll be some value. The funny thing about this is, unlike saying I've got Brembo brakes on the car and I can charge $8,000 for a premium brake package or Recaro seats, it's really tough to communicate to the end customer the difference between one, say, ADAS suite or chipset versus another. The chip makers are trying to discern that between their tier one customers and the auto industry, but at the end of the day, it's all very invisible. The strange thing about Intel is they made so much hay putting Intel inside into laptops and onto PCs. Almost a revolution in that regard, marketing their capability from a decal on the side of a laptop. They wish they could do that with cars. They're not going to, the OEMs aren't going to let them do that. So really, how do you discern as this chip battle continues, you know, what's better than another? What's more premium than another? I don't know.
Well, I'll come down to, does the person buying the car care?
Doesn't care at all.
They don't care.
Doesn't care at all. So, you know, point you made earlier, I mean, the auto industry has built its reputation on commoditizing everything. It was only a few years ago we looked at cameras on vehicles. And you'd think, how could they get the cost of a backup camera down? Well, now these things are just like popcorn. I mean, they're totally commoditized. Radar, the experts in Intel say, and Delphi, that's heading towards the commodity realm. It's not there yet. It's going to take a while, but radar will be somewhat commoditized. LiDAR, going to take a while. I mean, LiDAR still is not even affordable in the vehicle. But all of these things are going to be, it's the automotive process, is you make more of them, you continue to re-engineer and iterate them till the cost comes down.
I thought LiDAR had come down to where it is affordable. I thought the latest LiDAR units were about $250, but you need four of them.
You need four of them per car, so there's $1,000. And right. The solid state, I think, is going to take a lot of cost out, plus make them more reliable.
Yeah.
But, yeah, $1,000 for one.
But that's today. You know, in five years, they're not going to be 250.
Well, and that's what I'm saying, because 5 years ago, we looked at cameras and said, God, how long is
it
going to take? Right. So,
what do you guys make, too, of Delphi now splitting the company? They're going to spin off their powertrain operations, or, you know, their powertrain components. And what do you guys make of that?
It does feel strange. I mean, I'm certainly not plugged in to that realm, but it feels really strange to me to be having a conversation about, first of all, Delphi splitting off powertrain at all, but second of all, them being kind of a hot brand in Silicon Valley, or at least a known thing in Silicon Valley. You know, it feels like they're always kind of a legacy company to me. Although from some people that I've talked to, it does seem like they've been making smart investments over the last 5 years, that they've been kind of ahead of the curve where it comes to quote unquote mobility and really like getting in that side of the business is to be essentially the main business for them right now. So, or the bigger half anyways. So it's an interesting move from a name that I've been hearing my entire life. So,
well, not only that, but to your point, the powertrain is clearly the littler brother in
right.
this transaction. It's all about the bright, shiny object. And clearly this was driven by Wall Street. You know, investors didn't want to invest in the commoditized parts part of the business. They wanted to only invest and have the company focus its investment on, you know, the next generation vehicles. And so it's a bit of a leap of faith. I mean, they are earning money on this. But I was at a Delphi presentation a couple weeks ago about some of these acquisitions that they made. And I thought the interesting part of that was not just all this stuff that's going to come, you know, in 2020 and beyond, but there's a lot of vehicles on the road today that they think they can kind of retrofit to start getting some of that data out of and repackaging it and selling it. And I guess, you know, one question that remains to be answered is, you know, even if, say, LiDAR can get down to $10 a pop or whatever on these things, and you can have it on all four corners of the car, I guess there's a value proposition, too. I mean, if the once these things are commoditized, I guess the hope is that you can get the cost down so that there's still money to be made. But I wonder, too, I mean, how many car buyers are going to demand this? And there is a bit of a push down, you know, in terms of, you know, regulatory safety issues and that type of thing. But I wonder, too, about how many people are going to want to pay an extra $2,000 or $5,000 for, like, this ultimate package. You know, obviously, we're talking about less than a completely autonomous vehicle, but I think there's a lot of wishful thinking that people are going to want this. We need to make it for them. And I'm not so sure some of the surveys that have been done about that show that the consumer is quite there yet. So it's kind of interesting, this game of how far you go down that path of technology and whether the consumer is going to be there at the end of it.
Well, there's even discussion on, you know, the X amount of years into level four and level five autonomous vehicles, you know, are they going to be purchasable by us? Will they be basically fleet vehicles? Will they be very tightly controlled by the manufacturers? I think there's a pretty good argument to be made for that.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's how it's going to start out.
Yeah.
You know, when companies like Ford and BMW are saying we're going to have level four and five cars available in 2020, 2021.
That ain't going
to
be
talking
a showroom.
Fleets.
Right. Right.
Yeah, they're talking highly controlled.
Right.
I think, you know, you're talking 2025 and beyond.
Yeah.
Before you any of us can walk into a showroom and say, I want that autonomous car.
Yeah.
The other thing I think it's worth keeping in mind is the Trojan horse element of all this technology. And, you know, I don't want to be Debbie Downer, but I think there is a considerable cybersecurity risk. You know, it's one thing if your iPhone is hacked. It's another if your vehicle is when you're on the highway. So I think the industry, the traditional industry is just starting to come to grips with that. And I think Silicon Valley, too, is saying, don't worry about that. We got that. But I think we've seen a few cases here and there where they haven't got that. And there's these, you know, potential for misuse or worse. So at a minimum, it's going to be an extra cost for the industry to keep in mind to make sure that they're bulletproofing their technology and their vehicles. And potentially it could be a nightmare if, you know, you start to get the regulators involved and this starts to slow down some of this technology actually getting to market.
It could.
My first thought when I hear you talking about terabytes of data flowing through vehicles, right? Like the fact that it's not locked down all the time is, you know, suspicious.
Yeah. Well, the good news is it's so much data, the Russians won't be able to keep up with that.
Yeah. That's right.
You know, going back to Delphi, I think they're number one in the world as a major tier one supplier. I think they thought through this mobility thing far better than any other supplier.
And as Chester said, the acquisitions have been smart.
Oh, super smart. And because they're getting into data and they know that the data will be monetized. I know of no other tier one automotive supplier that's thought it as thoroughly through as Delphi has. The other thing is, you know, they're talking about changing their name. You know, right now they're talking about the powertrain operations that they're going to spin off. They call that SpinCo, and the rest of the stuff that they're going to keep as RemainCo. Mm-hmm. And I believe, this is my speculation, that they're going to let the powertrain operations take the Delphi name. Because Delphi, even though it's done a lot of great stuff in technology and the like, it's still viewed on Wall Street as an automotive name. And I think the RemainCo will come up with some, you know, Silicon Valley-like kind of name, high-tech.
Silco.
Something.
Right.
And so, yeah, I'm expecting to see Delphi change its name. Or like I said, you know, keep the name, but with the old powertrain operations.
We were joking in the office that they could pull some of their old brand names out of mothballs, and that, like, AC spark plug would be hilarious.
right.
Just for the T-shirts alone would be worth it, right?
Totally worth it. Another thing on that, you know, there is a possibility that Delphi might disappear both in name and in whole, because by spinning off the powertrain, not only do you make that a potential takeover target for somebody who wants to aggregate these commodity parts suppliers, but also, you know, one of the issues with Delphi is that it's got a fairly rich market cap, and they've been doing the right things, as you mentioned, and they're about $22 billion, which would be pretty tough for anybody to take over at that size. But now, this RemainCo, as you say, is going to be closer to $17 billion. Now, they'll still, that would still require a premium to be paid over that, but let's not forget that Intel paid about $15 billion and change for Mobileye. So suddenly, you know, if a savvy, say, Silicon Valley-based company really wanted to get in the Tier 1 space, well, you know, that's more of a possibility than it was a couple of weeks ago.
A great point. Yeah, and I think that's what I should say. What's interesting to me about Powertrain is they had an analyst call, they had a media call. I sat in on the media call and got to ask their CEO, I think his name's Kevin Clark, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't you sell it? And he essentially said, oh, we can't comment on that. That, I mean, if I'm reading the tea leaves, it sounds to me like they did try to sell it. Nobody was buying, and now they're spinning it off as its own separate company. And I think the reason that they want to get rid of it is, why continue to invest CapEx? Why put, you know, capital expenditures into these traditional powertrain kinds of, even though they're bleeding edge, mm-hmm. you know, but it's still internal combustion engine kind of stuff. Why not take all that money and invest it in the sexy stuff that Wall Street really likes? And that's what I'm reading this as. Is I hadn't thought about that, as setting yourself up to be bought out. That's pretty good. But I think the immediate step is, let's get rid of Powertrain. Now we don't have to invest in it. We can take all that money and put it elsewhere.
And that's kind of a trend. I mean, Continental last week, I think it was, you know, made rumblings about this. They reorganized, trying to separate the electronic, connected, autonomous part of Conti from their traditional business. Both of them have 48-volt systems, which are state-of-the-art, but it is kind of hybridization versus electrification and autonomy. So it's more of a short-term, kind of mid-term play with that. Delphi's got some lean burn combustion technology. It's very advanced. Again, short-term to mid-term. So I think some IP goes along with this Delphi spinoff as well. I think Bosch is doing the same thing. I mean, getting rid of some you know, powertrain component sets.
Starters and alternators. They just sold that off to a Chinese group.
And I could see, I mean, I asked Greg DeVos about this, or Glenn DeVos about this.
At Delphi. CTO.
CTO. And that's as far as he would go, is, you know, he's just kind of keeping it the way it is right now. We're not going to really talk about what we intend to do with this. But you could see a major, just like, you know, Chinese glass companies, Chinese, you know, gray metal companies are coming to this market. I could see a big acquisitor for Delphi Powertrain.
And just I interviewed Kevin Clark yesterday after the deal came out, and he really went out of his way to say that although they're spinning this powertrain unit off, if the right buyer came along, they'd still be willing to sell. And as Lindsay said, they've still got a year before this thing closes, so we may yet see another page turn.
Mm-hmm. I think the internal combustion engine is going to be around a lot longer than most people think. You know, there's some report that just came out this week that said by 2030, which is right around the corner, really. In automotive terms, you know, that's just a couple of design cycles.
Yeah, 2.5 design cycles.
So they're saying by 2030 in the United States, 95% of all vehicle miles traveled is going to be in electrified shared vehicles. And I think that's, I think it's totally bogus.
Yeah.
I think, and look, I'm all in favor of this happening. I just don't believe it's going to happen that quickly. Because it takes, right now in the United States, 22 years to turn the fleet over. So the 2017 cars rolling off the line right now will not be completely off the road until 2039.
Right.
And, you know, so, and then you take it out, okay, by 2020, that means it's going to be not until 2042 that the 2020 vehicles are completely off. So, you know, things turn over much more slowly than I think the tech people seem to be aware of. And that's why I think the internal combustion engine, which is a moving target, keeps getting better all the time, cleaner, more affordable. It's going to be around a lot longer, and especially if you get into any kind of decarbonized gasoline with biofuel or whatever, now you're going to have a pretty strong argument that it's got a fairly small carbon footprint to it.
I agree, and it's still a money spinner in terms of the extra cost of batteries, which are coming down, but not as fast as everybody thinks they are. The difference between GM and the incumbents versus the startups is they still make their money selling internal combustion engine vehicles at, you know, at a profit versus using someone's money to fund the next R&D program. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Bill, the other thing is that environmentally speaking, I mean, if that's the big sell for electric vehicles, I don't really think it can be, because not everybody's going to want just to, you know, wear green lapels. But even if that is the case, you know, there's a significant body of knowledge that shows on a wheel-to-well basis that, you know, if everybody's driving an electric car, that electricity has got to come from somewhere. And there's a lot of countries around the world. There's a lot of parts of this country which are largely dependent on coal-fired generation. So, I mean, you know, yes, if all of the coal-fired plants become, powered by natural gas, you know, that's one step. But they're not all going to be powered by windmills either. So I think there's a little bit of legerdemain here in terms of, you know, just how green is that vehicle, particularly when you get to a point where it's no longer a niche, but, you know, a significant number of the car driving public is driving electric vehicles. You know, where that electricity comes from, I think, is going to increasingly come into play.
I would add, too, that we have to start looking at how energy intense it is to manufacture batteries. You know, most people don't know this. I've been to the battery factory. You got to bake these things in ovens at very high temperatures for 6 weeks. I was at the Nissan battery plant a while back, and, you know, they use what they call the prismatic batteries. They look like TV dinners. You know, they're these little
pouch.
You know, a little pouch kind of a thing. You put it in the oven for 3 weeks, baking it constantly, 24 hours a day at high temperature. 3 weeks, you pull it out, you slit it open to degas it, you tape it back up and put it back in the oven for another 3 weeks. And the Union of Concerned Scientists has estimated that an electric car with a 240-mile range starts out life, rolls off the assembly line with a carbon footprint that's 68% larger than a piston engine car. So we've got to look at the energy that goes into making these things. And then at the other end, we have no way of recycling these lithium-ion batteries. Technically, we know how to do it. Nobody knows how to do it in high volume and make a profit at it. There is one company in the United States that says it can do it, but they're not doing it because, number one, the batteries just haven't come back
in volume
yet, right? So, but at some point, we're going to have zillions of these batteries, and if all we go is put it in the landfill, how green is that?
I don't know that the needle really gets moved meaningfully because of a sense of concern for the environment either. I mean, I think people ultimately are making these decisions on really rational, sort of boring basis, right? Like they want to, can they afford it? Does it make sense for their lifestyle? Is it cheaper to run on a day-to-day basis? And as you say, like until we get the cost of manufacture, the cost of the batteries down.
And the recycling.
And the recycling, like, yeah, so many elements have to come together. I think people want it because it seems like the future and it seems inherently better on an end user basis right now. But I don't know, getting to the point where you're talking about 95% of road miles, it does feel like it's a little bit further down the road, as it were.
Another thing. Last week I had a Chevy Bolt EV, which I love. I really like the car.
Yeah.
And so Chevy called me and said, hey, you know, there's all kinds of level 3 chargers around you. And I'm like, you're kidding. And they showed me how to get online or on the screen on the car, and you can search out these level 3 chargers. Well, there's one that's just a few miles away from the office here. So I thought, I'm going to go give this thing, you know, a big jolt of juice. And so I pulled up, and it's next to a party store. It's only one charger. So thank God nobody was there in front of me, because otherwise I'd have to, and it goes for 30 minutes at a time. You plug in, and it'll charge for 30 minutes. So thank God I didn't have to wait 30 minutes for somebody else to get in there. I plug it in. It's $6 just to plug in before you even start charging the thing.
It's like an air pump, you know, filling up your car. It's $1.50, yeah. You know? Right. You know? It's just,
right. So I paid, it's at $5.95. I recharged for 30 minutes. I got about 60 minutes range, or 60 miles of range. That was another $6. So I paid $12 to go 60 miles, And one of the big arguments in favor of electric cars is it's a lot cheaper to operate
right.
than filling up with gasoline. Well, that's true if you're charging at home. But if you start using these level three chargers, man, it's no cheaper.
And the market will definitely take off with that. I mean, if you've got a restaurant or a convenience store or whatever, there's going to be some money to be made from that.
I will say we just had Cadillac in the office the other day, and they were showing off their CT6 plug-in hybrid, which is cool. But we were talking about the chargers at home too. The cost of the home units that you put in your garage have come down a lot yeah. in the last couple of years. So I think now with a Bolt, you can wrap it into your lease, and it's under $500 or around that range.
Yeah, and a few years ago it was about $2,000.
Right, exactly.
Now that was to get the unit and hire an electrician right. to wire it in your house.
Yeah, yeah, right. sure. From the Chevy program? I don't know. I don't know if it included installation or not.
No, I don't think it does. I think it's just the unit itself, but still, it's a whole lot cheaper than it used.
Well, you're a handy guy. You can...
Not to get too wonky, but again, if you start having more and more of these electricity demands on the grid... and you want to, say, move from coal to gas, I mean, someone's going to have to pay that cost. And in some jurisdictions like, say, Ontario, where they're trying to force that through by going much greener and kind of really promoting the use of electric vehicles, what's happening is you're seeing the power bills start to go up. So, yeah, you can charge at home, but if you're paying twice as much for electricity because the demands are such, again, demand and supply, and somebody's got to make those large upstream investments. The other thing is, I think with oil prices, too, everybody fears, you know, $5 a gallon at the pump. And I'm not saying that can never happen, but you are seeing an incredible technology renaissance in things like shale oil, which have really kept the price low and confounded a lot of experts. And, hey, whatever happened to the peak oil right. debate, right? I mean, 10 years ago, that's all anybody could ever talk about. Mm-hmm. Now nobody's talking about that. So I think the idea, too, that, I mean, part of it, your question whether someone's going to buy a car just because it's environmentally friendly to do so. I mean, there are people like that. But the other pressure, the economics pressure, I'm not so sure that oil is necessarily going to be in such short supply that it forces people to do that. I think people still want to pay less, and the internal combustion engine will get more efficient. And, you know, that's just a dynamic of greater competition in the marketplace. But again, the ideal, there's some finite supply of oil, and we're all racing toward that day when there's going to be no more oil. I think that has kind of been shown not necessarily to be the case, maybe in 100 years, but not in our lifetime.
No, I totally agree with you. You know, and two points I would add to that. Number one, with all this fracking that's going on that's really changed the game, it's largely only the United States so far that has gotten into fracking in a big way. And there are other places in the world that could do a whole lot more of it, i.e., to add to your argument, we could have even more of this, especially natural gas, available. And secondly, the United States is now using less gasoline than it did 10 years ago, even though there are many millions more cars on the road. So these fuel efficiency laws are having an impact. You know, we're using less gas with more cars on the road, and I think fracking's going to spread to other places of the world. You never want to say never. I don't ever see oil prices going up unless there's a war or some other major conflagration.
Sure.
Hey, we're getting all kinds of questions coming in here from the audience. Let's go through some of this. Our work says, I see a lot of 200s around here. I guess he's talking Chrysler 200s. Is there a giveaway going on? Well, yeah, there is, right? I mean, have they stopped production of the plant?
I thought they did.
I think they did.
The 200 is officially out of production.
Because they're putting the Ram pickup in there.
Right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right.
And
200's still in the pool, so to speak?
Well, they got inventory to work off, and I'm sure dealers are happy to get...
Yeah, are dealing.
We were joking earlier, if you want a great deal, go buy a passenger car. I'll bet you get a killer deal
on
the Chrysler 200.
I agree.
I think inventories of 2016 models are considerably higher now than they were year over year, too, so there might be, you know, 200s amongst that group, for sure.
He also says the Vin Diesel ad is funny. Another spoof of that terrific Lincoln ad. I haven't seen
Vin Diesel either.
Ad.
No,
I missed it.
Okay. Once again, the audience is ahead of the panel. Okay. Chuck Grenchy wants to know, what's the take on the panel of Tesla saying that their new vehicle, the Model 3, is still on time?
Don't believe it. It's mine. He hasn't hit deadlines. They did get the Falcon 9 up the other day without any incident, which is still a big deal.
Landed. Amazing. Did you see the landing?
Landed it, right.
On land.
Right, right.
It looked like a science fiction movie.
That yeah.
Thing landed.
I thought it was cool. I don't think, I think if he makes Model 3, if he makes his deadline, it's going to be a small batch of white-gloved, very finessed cars off the line to be able to tell the investment community that we made this deadline. It's going to be very low on the production curve. But I wouldn't bet on it.
See, I think he will start building cars in July. That's what he's promised everybody.
Oh, I do too.
But I think you're right, Lindsay. Yeah. It's going to be, you know, one a day kind of a thing
yeah.
to start with. And one of the reasons I say that, and I know this for a fact, is that production equipment suppliers were told, get your equipment in. And when they're told, but, you know, we still have to do our cycle testing, and all, it was like, don't do any of that. Just go through the checklist, finish up everything that you got to do, ship it. So I think they're going to do all their production equipment testing on the floor of the plant. And that's going to be a very slow ramp up.
A slow ramp up. I mean, you look at Model X, it had a number of assembly issues and quality issues. You know, Musk the other day was talking about level 5 autonomy by 2019. He really needs to look at Model 3, getting it clean, a clean launch of this car. That's the most important thing for them right now, I think.
No, yeah. But you know what? All the investors will be happy as pigs if one rolls off the line in July. It'll be woohoo! The stock will go to 600.
Yeah, right.
It keeps them in the news cycle. It keeps that rolling. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's funny. I was talking to one of my sources on Wall Street, and that's what they said. That this is what they're saying on Wall Street now. Don't look at the numbers. Throw logic out the window. Just go buy the stock because it's going to 500. Okay, Mike from San Francisco says, one would have to suspect something dramatic as even the transition he's talking about the Corvette. And, mm-hmm. As the transition from the C6 to the C7 did not close things for 18 months. He says this is like Lockheed Martin rebuilding their F-35 factory.
Well,
yeah, I mean, like we were talking about before, they could be doing a number of things. They're talking about the tour. They could be spiffing up the place and making it just look more modern and spectacular for people coming through. But there's definitely something behind it other than just making a better tour for when we want to walk through.
One would think.
I understand that new Corvette's being developed in a shop in Warren in Milford where the presidential limousine is dealt with, like uber security in that building. And I've seen Google Earth pictures of that. It's like building 8 or whatever. But it's part of it is presidential limousine. Nobody goes in there. The other part is C8 Corvette.
No kidding. Ooh, interesting. And speaking of vet, Jay Siegel says, so is there going to be a family of vets? He says, I'd love a down market vet junior. I don't think they'd go down market at all. Go buy a Camaro. That's what Camaro's for.
But in that plant, and speaking to what Seth was saying about this plant being reconfigured, we think, would they keep a line for C7 in there to keep that, you know, $60,000 Corvette to
Absolutely.
Keep the price point down? Why not? Why not continue to build this car out, the rear drive car?
That's the argument that makes the most sense to me, you know, that you're going to have kind of the traditional Corvette carry on yeah. and maybe even continue to iterate as the mid-engine comes on. Because there's room above, I think, where Corvette is now. I'm not sure about below where C7 exists.
Well, there's an interesting question, too, and I'm going to speak heresy now, I know, but, you know, any other company might have done more with that brand. And I know it's GM and there's a whole legacy there, but you know, why not have a Corvette SUV? You know, I mean, everybody else is doing it, and I'm sure there's a market out there for it. Now, of course, there's probably some people who are turning over in their graves or pulling their hair out, but you know, you do wonder why can't they be a bit more creative with the brand? They kind of got it hermetically sealed, and you do think that there may be leaving some money on the table by thinking about it that way.
Oh, yeah, and they've had these discussions within General Motors. But I can tell you the thinking, at least up to now, has been, nope, it's a Corvette's a Chevrolet, and it's always going to be a Chevrolet, and it's just part of the lineup, and it's important to bring people into the showroom. They come in to look at the Vette, and they walk out with a Cruze or something else. But I'm with you, Chester. I mean, I think they're leaving a lot of money on the table. When, you know, if you use Porsche as an example of what could be done, Yowza, there's billions being left on the table.
And you probably had a show at one point when the Porsche SUV was first being discussed, and your guest probably said, a Porsche SUV?
Yeah. Yeah. The end of the world.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And it was.
it must be said, it's the profit driver
absolutely.
For Porsche these days, without any question. Well,
and we are in the era of the sub-brand now, and sort of the sub-sub-brand. If Buick gets one, it seems like that Corvette could definitely stand alone. Right?
Well, but also headroom, too, because what did you say the McLaren was? The new McLaren is $300,000?
Yeah, there's one below it that's more like $200,000, $180,000, something like
and
that.
And the new Ford GT is in the fours?
$400,000.
So GM's looking at this. You know, a ZL1 or Z06, you know, the top line Corvette right now is about $100,000, right?
I want to say.
110. Mm-hmm. Still a big delta between that and a Ford GT or a McLaren. Yeah,
I mean, Porsche 911 Turbo is $190,000 these days. So there is a ton of space in the super sports car world to get something above Corvette now. And frankly, GM doesn't have a problem making performance to compete with those cars. So making something that's a bargain proposition version versus a Ferrari or a Porsche 911, I think is a cool idea.
Okay, hold those thoughts. We're going to come back to this, but we got to take another break right now because Bridgestone is another company that supports this program. Okay, we're back and going through some of the questions from the audience. We got one here from Richard Setter, who had actually called in, but Richard, it was a little bit too long, so we're going to go with the print version here, as it were. And he asks, so I'll throw it out to the panel, can you tell us if the Buick Enclave Avenir will offer a second row option bench seat rather than two bucket seats?
Whew. No idea.
Yeah, I
have no idea. I mean,
it's a good thing you asked the automotive experts here.
No clue. It doesn't really seem to fit with the brand as they're proposing it right now to have a bench seat. It's obviously more the high end sort of luxed out version. So I don't know.
JD heard us talking about gasoline prices. He says gasoline is $5.27 a gallon in Ontario, Canada today. That's $1.16 a liter. I had no idea fuel prices were that high in Canada.
Oh, yeah. I actually just moved to Detroit from Calgary, Alberta in January. I spent 4 years there. And, gas is at least three times as expensive. And mind you, it's incredibly ironic because Alberta is where the oil sands are, the tar sands that have got such a black name. But Canada is, in fact, the largest exporter of we import more oil from Canada than from any other country on the planet. A lot of people don't know that either. So it's incredibly ironic that Canada exports the raw material but doesn't really have enough refineries, particularly in the western part of the country. So a lot of the gasoline is actually re-imported as a refined product. But in any case, there are huge taxes in Canada right across the board.
It's got to be like $3 a gallon tax just about.
Yeah, and there's a... You know, it's one thing in Ontario or particularly Toronto where there's a lot of public transport options. But, Canada is a big, wide country. And I can tell you, having been living and working in Alberta, people think nothing of driving 3 or even 6 hours to get anywhere. This is a part of the world where, gas prices have a big impact on your spending budget, right? And when you're paying that much more, there's all sorts of carbon taxes as well, and just it's become a it's the gift that keeps on giving for the policymakers, but Canadians are paying a pretty stiff price for it. And some of it is policy driven. They want to get people more into electric vehicles, and that's all well and fine in Ontario, which is largely hydropower driven. But the further west you get, the more they depend on other sources, including coal, to generate their electricity. So Canada's got some policy issues to work out, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Let's see. S10 Baja says, will the 2017 Bolt have a shorter model year and align with a fall of 2017 for a 2018 model year? I'm not sure if... I don't know.
How long has it been for sale? I mean, it's pretty much a full 17 car, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want to say the Bolt went on sale in very, very small numbers in California only this past December.
Right. Okay. Yeah, beginning of the year.
Yeah,
so sort of a slower rollout. So it depends on what you want to consider, I guess, a full model year. 18 will be the first full model year of it really having 50 state availability, for sure. But I'm not sure if that answers the specific question.
You know, a lot of, and I'm a little hazy on the details, but a lot of what drove the whole model year thing is what you had to certify for fuel economy and emissions.
Right.
With an electric car, you don't need any of that.
Yeah.
So does the model year become less important? I mean, and when I say certify, I mean, you had to pay the EPA, like, you know, $100,000 per engine iteration and all that to certify every single year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think it's going to go away. It's still a way to tell that I've got a newer car than you.
It's a good marketing tool. You
know, yeah, it's a marketing tool, right.
Well, I was struck. Unless I'm mistaken, I was looking at Toyota's lineup online the other day, and they had some 2018 vehicles, and I'm thinking, that's pretty early for a 2018. I mean, I don't know what the rule of thumb is these days, but, I mean, we're just, you know, 5 months into 2017. Is it really possible? Is that the new normal?
And again, this comes back to the certification for emissions and fuel economy I was talking about. I'm a little bit hazy. I think you can start calling something like the next year model year. So you can start calling things a 2018 as of February or March. And then, so you certify now, you get almost all of 2017, you have all of 2018, and you don't have to recertify again until the 2019 model year. So it's a money-saving thing, and it's a marketing thing. Oh, I got the 2018, even though it's not 2018.
Yeah, because I was thinking back in the day, I may be mistaken, but I was thinking that, like, didn't it used to be that Labor Day was kind of considered the, you know, you'd start to see the next year models come out. I'm dating myself by, you know, this is probably 20 years ago, but,
you're right.
But I feel like that was the norm, and all of a sudden, you know, it's to hear that, you know, as soon as March, you can start talking about the next year model. I mean, we've come a long way.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And, you know, again, automakers love to sell the newest, greatest stuff. So even if the car hasn't changed much, but you can say it's the 2018, people will go for it. Okay, this one goes to you, Seth. Mohammed Al-Dayan, I hope I said that right, or Al-Dayan, said, is McLaren moving too fast introducing new cars? He says, I'll bet 650S prices are plummeting.
I don't know. I think that the residuals are fairly strong. I don't think that they're moving faster than they've intended to. I think that they're following a pretty well-constructed plan that they put together from the very beginning. So my argument would be they're right now selling or have orders for more cars than they can build, or as fast as they can build anyways. So I don't really see the downside there.
Yeah, I doubt the prices of the S or the 650 are plummeting.
Yeah.
Because to your point, and McLaren knows this well, just like Ferrari and the other supercar guys do, you never meet demand.
Right.
You always build one less than there is demand for, because that keeps the prices up.
The volumes on all these are so low, and when you have something like the 650 and then you bring out the 675 Longtail to follow it up, that's another higher performance and more limited edition too, it keeps everything in a really special zone that I think it makes the collectors happy and makes us sort of poor people happy about getting in the cars too.
Okay, last question here. Royal with Cheese wants to know, do you guys think that all the excitement surrounding Fernando Alonso's attempt at the Indy 500 will translate into more IndyCar fans long term?
Oh, man. I don't know. The long-term prospect of any IndyCar fan seems dubious to me, to be completely honest. I don't know, though. It goes back and forth. I get so frustrated with racing because it's amazing when you're there. It's especially for somebody that's into cars. I think it's the technology can be phenomenal and it's really exciting. But the history of it in the U.S. is so marked with failure that it's hard for me, to at least, to predict a promising future.
Look, I'm a big IndyCar and F1 and all kinds of motor racing fan. I think it's terrific that Alonso is coming to the Indy 500. I think it's really good for him too, because clearly, McLaren and Formula One this year is a complete and total disaster.
Yeah, that's true.
Complete and total. And I think him coming here, Alonso coming to the Indy 500, has really increased the buzz. I heard that 2 million people watched his first oval test at Indy on streaming it. I mean, Indy doesn't get any kind of numbers like that.
It's kind of like I remember as a kid when Jimmy Clark and Graham Hill came to Indy, and it was like, I can't believe it. You know, this is a real big deal.
Yeah.
So I think there's some of that in there.
No, I think there is. But I think it will increase a lot of viewership of this year's Indy 500.
Yeah, but
a long term, nah.
Will it increase it? Will the viewers be coming from the U.S. or will they be watching it from elsewhere?
No, elsewhere. Yeah. But that's where you get growth. You know, instead of who cares if all the regular fans tune in? You know, you got the regular fans. If all kinds of people, especially I think the entire or a good chunk of the Formula One audience is going to tune in to see how's our Fernando doing.
Sure. I mean, I guess my argument would be that long-term growth is better benefited by more a bigger American audience getting interested in it. People who aren't hardcore but who are brought into the fold from the States, especially for the 500.
You're kind of growing the grassroots.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, look, we're coming up to the top of the hour here. I guess it's time to shut this conversation down, but it's been a really good one. We've been all over the map with all kinds of things. I want to let you guys know and let the audience know, too, this is the 20th anniversary of Autoline.
All right.
So, yeah.
Congratulations.
20 years we've been at this thing. Not with this show. This show started later, but when we first got going here, it was 20 years ago. I can't believe it. So we'll be having some sort of big bash later on.
Sounds good.
Impressive. Yeah.
But, yeah, I want to thank all you guys. Lindsay Brook from SAE. Seth Meyersma from Motor1.com. Mm-hmm. I'll throw in the .com. And Chester Dawson from The Wall Street Journal. Good having all three of you guys here.
Great to be here.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
And want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.